Take a network break, steep a hot cup of tea, visualize the perfect virtual donut, and join us as we dash through this week's tech news. I'm your host, Drew Conry Murray, and joining me is Greg Farrow and guest pontificator Mike Fratto. Before we jump into the news, I want to thank today's sponsor. This episode of Network Break is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. Okay, apologies in advance. This is going to be a very Cisco-centric show because Cisco Live US has just wrapped up as we're recording. So let's jump right in. Cisco announced several new products, including StealthWatch Learning Networks. This is an extension of the Lancope StealthWatch product that Cisco acquired. My understanding is you put a little agent on an ISR branch router. The agent looks for anomalous or malicious traffic, and it uses NetFlow application recognition and packet capture, and that agent's managed from a central console.
So it's not an agent, Drew. It's actually a feature that's been in Cisco routers for about 15 years, and Cisco's finally decided to make use of it.
Okay, so, what feature is this?
It's called NetFlow. It's well known. We've all known about it for quite some time, but it's never been used. It's always been possible to use it, but there's been lots of practical implementation problems, and Cisco has done about 3 or 4 attempts at making use of NetFlow, and this time, as you said, it's part of the. This product is literally from the Lancope acquisition, where it was called StealthWatch, and now it's called Cisco StealthWatch, and by feeding the flow data into an analysis engine, you get visibility because you get a flow record off the router, and so you can get charts of, you know, speeds and feeds. You can get the basics, but you can also get visibility into, because the flow record has things like TCP ports and headers and stuff, you can actually now say, oh, people are going here, people are going there. And then you can then use it as a security tool. You can use it against malware. Certain types of malware will pop up in a flow record if you know what you're looking for. You can do some detect denial of service. So if there's too many flows or a certain type of flows, it's easy to pattern match that. And you can also do some logging of what people are looking at. It's all pretty great.
Yeah, so there's another component to this. So everything that Greg just described, that's been in Lancope, StealthWatch, since its inception. And it's a pretty deep product, and there are some other products in that space like QRadar and there are a few others that are really interesting. What the license is doing is, one, it's NetFlow, but it's also combining the NBAR application recognition, which is also being stuffed into those records. So what Lancope would get were just NetFlow records, which is just flows. Mm-hmm. With NBAR, they're getting the application detection out of NBAR as well.
Mm. So in addition to the StealthWatch Learning Network, Cisco also announced two other security offerings. One is Umbrella Branch, which takes advantage of OpenDNS, another Cisco acquisition, to secure guest wireless access at branch offices by blocking users from malicious websites. And that's also a software package that gets installed on your ISR branch router. The company also announced the Cisco Meraki MX Security Appliance. That's a cloud-managed UTM appliance. It's got firewalling, intrusion prevention, VPN, content filtering, etc.
It's confusing, isn't it, Mike? Do you ever get the sense that the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing? There's all these different things going in all different directions, and it's very difficult to decode them all.
That's somewhat purposeful.
Yeah? Why would that be?
So Cisco has historically had a lot of sort of internal competition among their various business units, and that's very much true with Meraki and the rest of Cisco. So, they run their businesses relatively independently, and the people certainly talk amongst each other. But
does it still make sense? Like, I think when Cisco was the dominant supplier in that category, and effectively it was 3 or 4 companies all competing to get the same customers within under the name one brand. So it made sure that competitors didn't come in. But I'm not sure that applies in the modern era. Does that business model need to die? Like, there's every sign that Chuck Robbins is killing that off.
Yeah, there were some clear indications at the keynote and then elsewhere with the event that we attended that he's going to start breaking down some of those silos across a lot of their business units, which I think is going to be much more effective because there's a lot of duplication of effort. You know, all of this stuff basically gets resolved in the channel. So the channel sort of makes the decision, do we go, or the customer, either one, to go with Meraki or Aeronet in this particular example, or the different product sets. So the conflict, the competition inside Cisco is more around resources and development and product development and what have you, and then it gets resolved out with the sales force.
So my question is, this StealthWatch Learning Network and the Umbrella Branch are both trying to leverage the ISR And I wonder if Cisco is maybe feeling some pressure from SD-WAN vendors who've been encroaching on the branch router, saying, you know, you can put our SD-WAN thing in and you can put it behind a router if you want, but you could also eventually get rid of that router. And is Cisco trying to make the router more valuable and, you know, keep that territory that it's got?
Absolutely. Not only among enterprise customers, but more importantly, service provider customers.
Mm. Right. You've got to remember the ISR is fundamentally a $1,000 x86 server packaged up. It's got some unicorn tiers onto it, so it has some extra hardware features to make it a little bit more valuable and a little bit more useful, but it's still only a $1,000 x86 server underneath that they're still selling for $10,000, $20,000, $40,000 a throw. So to justify that, you've got to be able to value add to that underlying product. Mm-hmm. And StealthWatch and Umbrella Branch and, you know, a whole raft of other things, you know, this ability to run containers, start to use the NetFlow, starts to leverage the value that's being undermined. Now, when I say undermined, you can now go and get, a distribution based on Linux that you can put on any server with a couple of NICs in it, and you've got a router that's probably faster pound for pound than Cisco, or albeit at a price administratively. So Cisco has to do something in this space to do that. Now, Umbrella Branch is basically the product that comes through from OpenDNS acquisition. Cisco bought OpenDNS, I don't know, 18 months ago, I think, from the top of my head, and what they do is they use the DNS features, the DNS database that OpenDNS is using by collecting all the records from all over the internet to block DNS lookup. So it's fundamentally a DNS firewall. And because OpenDNS knows what those domain names and those URLs and has a big URL database, it's then able to block at the edge of the network and say, don't go to these domains. These domains are categorized as this. Mm-hmm. This is very duplicated. There's a product called IronPort, which has exactly the same database.
that would also be a Cisco product from an acquisition.
That's right. And then there's also the Mail Gateway product, which has another one of these. So that makes three, right? So it's a little bit confusing. I think the confusion level for customers is really going to be a problem going forward. And assuming that resellers are smart enough to discriminate between all of these products is actually a fallacy, I think, because the majority of resellers don't have any skills. They've been de-skilling and just relying on what Cisco hands them and moving it from left hand to the right hand and taking a profit out of it. This is not everybody. This is just the larger part of the industry. And they don't have the necessary bandwidth to understand all the technologies. And assuming that the customer is smart and economically rational and capable of evaluating products that exactly fit their needs isn't correct in my view.
The challenge that VARs are having, and this is true for any, you know, VARs from any vendor, not just Cisco, is how do they get their sales force, essentially their sales force, to turn from what they call the race to the SKU, which is I need 1,000 ports in 5 different locations. These are the boxes that I need. Get them, which they can do very quickly, and get them into that longer term sales cycle for services, which will take longer, and not only that, but it's their remuneration plans change. Mm. And so there's going to be across the industry, and Cisco's going to have to deal with this as well, how do they change from the way things are being sold today to the longer-term model, and when subscription pricing starts hitting, then that's really going to impact compensation plans. And so there's a whole raft of things that have to happen that all vendors are going through. Cisco's, you know, just one of them.
That's something I was actually thinking about this week. It's funny that you bring that up, because I can remember back in the days when we used to sell goods, you know, and then the day it was sold, commission was recognized. And then at some point in my career, I was working for companies that were doing telephones. Remember when smartphones first came out and the business, it was a huge sales opportunity in selling handsets. And it wasn't the handset that you made money on, because the handset was a loss leader. For every SIM that you sold, you would make £10 a month or $10 a month as a sales rep. And you would make that every month. So if you could sell 10,000 SIMs in 3 months, you would be getting $100,000 a month every month from then on in. Huh. And this is what's happening with software sales, is customers are signing up through the resellers. And the question is, where does that revenue go? Does it go to the sales rep, or does it go to the reseller? And there's some interesting dynamics here, because the longer a reseller stays in business, the more revenue it gets off trailing commissions or trailing revenue. That is, customers mm-hmm. who've got, you know, a Meraki price. If you just stay in business, you don't actually have to be very good. You just have to be able to stay in business and keep selling something. And over time, you build up this trailing revenue. And this is what happened to the smartphone business 5 to 10 years ago. Eventually, you had these companies whose whole game was to just hire sales reps to sell SIMs. They didn't care where the sales came from. And then all they did was just rake in these mammoth profits from the trailing commission off the back of SIM cards, off the back of these plan sales. And this is something I'm sure the vendors are knowing about, but I think you're going to have some real disruption in the reseller market where the less reputable, the ones who are focused on the short-term game, are going to be out there selling these software packages at a great rate of knots. And then at some point, those guys can walk away, stop selling, but still be taking a fortune in subscription revenue, even though they've shut up shop.
Well, Greg, I want to show you my new business plan. I'll email it to you.
I want to set an online store, cheapest Cisco subscription revenue. Come here, click a button, and the subscription, you know, can you imagine that?
Watch your bank account grow.
No sales reps, no whatever. Anyway, it's just part of this shift with, you know, and of course, once you're buying software subscription revenue, why are you dealing with resellers at all? Why don't you just go to a website direct from Cisco and click renew?
Yeah.
I'm not convinced resellers have a role to play in the future. I think that over time, resellers, you know, sooner rather than later, not 20 or 30 years, I think 5 to 10 years, there won't be resellers. The middlemen have to go.
Okay, a little bit more Cisco news. We all know Cisco ACI and VMware NSX, they're competing for data center dollars, but both companies also have said that these products aren't mutually exclusive, that buying one doesn't necessarily mean you can't use the other and get value from it. So CRN's reporting on comments from a Cisco executive at Cisco Live US saying that there is a roadmap for ACI and NSX convergence. The executive is quoted as saying, "There's a set of feature requests that our customers are asking for, and the common theme has been we want to see VMware and Cisco work together closely." There aren't any details on what those feature requests are or when this roadmap might come to fruition. Is this just happy talk, or do you think these two companies are actually trying to work together on this?
No, I think they're actually trying to work together on it. I mean, when I talked to both VMware and Cisco, the representatives, about this rift, the response is invariably, what do you mean? Why would you use both? And then they would follow up with, it's not mutually exclusive. And so, yes, you can run NSX over ACI, and ACI just sees UDP traffic. And then when I tell them, well, I've talked to enterprises and they really want integration, they want to be able to, you know, have visibility in both areas, both sections or levels. They want to be able to manage and monitor and work in their workflows, and they want this integration. You know, they just kind of nod their heads and then off they go. So it's actually good that they're talking about it, but, you know, let's start seeing some proof.
So we recorded a show, I think it's might be publishing today, Drew, like about the same time as this gun goes out, where a VMware customer who's running NSX, big fans of NSX as well, are also running Cisco ACI. And what they said is ACI is very useful to them for just orchestrating the physical stuff. They don't use it very often. They don't really need it. But they said it was very useful to be able to have it there so they didn't actually have to play with the command line or know about networking. They're not networking people. They said it just meant we didn't have to futz with it. But they, in that case, they're not using any of the advanced features of ACI. They have ACI, but they're just using it to configure ports and get some visibility, right?
So you're saying ACI is the network automation piece, but they're not bothering with the whole sort of northbound application integration and, you know, all that stuff that's supposed to be all the goodness.
Well, in this particular case, I'm not saying that customers generally don't. I'm just saying in this particular example. And then they had VMware NSX for everything else. They used it for VDI. They used it for DMZs. They used NSX for all the servers so that they could do micro-segmentation in their data center. So there's an example of that, and that's a well-trend. I think what you're seeing here is now that MPLS, remember we talked over the last few weeks about the people who are in charge of NCME, now that they've been moved out of the scene, we're seeing some grey open up behavior. As I've said before, they had a reputation for being extremely combative, very aggressive in sales, and not very good at partnering. They saw customers as things to exploit, to be pushed, to be bullied, and now they're out of the way. We're seeing a much more mature, customer-centric approach, which is, you know, Cisco and VMware, we need you to work together because we have VMware, we have Cisco, we need you to work together. And if you don't, we're not going to buy either of you. We're going to go and get OpenStack and buy somebody else's networking platform because we're not going to put up with children arguing in front of the adults.
My question is, it seems like having ACI and NSX together is a very expensive way to go about things.
Yeah, sure. But nobody ever said, I'll go back to my original point, enterprise IT is not a rational, economic, well-informed, knowledgeable, you know, value for money enhanced operation. It buys from the gut. It buys on brand. It buys. It's a luxury market. People will quite happily pay to have a Hermes handbag and a Rolex watch and still feel that they need to go out and buy fashionable clothes to complete the ensemble. And welcome to enterprise IT. There's no money is no object for enterprise IT. They talk about it. They pretend that money matters, but actually it doesn't. If money really mattered, they wouldn't be buying brands like, you know, any of the brands that they have, IBM, HPE, Cisco, IBM, Oracle. You wouldn't buy those products because they're just brands. They're no better than other people's products, but, you know, we know the brand, we trust the brand, we'll spend the money, you know.
Okay. Interesting outlook.
Is that a little too cynical for a Friday?
It's very cynical. Very cynical. But that's fine. I mean, I think an argument can be made and probably an argument to the counter, but we'll leave it there for a minute. Another story, Seamus McGillicuddy, Enterprise Management Associates, he posted a blog about how Cisco executives are telling him that it's time for network engineers to become less reliant on their CLI skills. Here's a quote from his blog. Cisco executives told me they want a significant portion of networking professionals to start coding. And by coding, they don't mean writing CLI scripts. They want network engineers to work with Cisco's APIs, which they consider a better abstraction layer than CLI. So as Seamus notes, this is a big deal because for years Cisco has been emphasizing CLI training.
Well, yeah, of course. And what Cisco's training, all credit to Cisco's training people of years gone by, not so much today, but of years gone by. Cisco has always made a point of at least half of a course is theory and fundamentals. So you don't just learn how to configure something, you learn how it works and why the protocol does what it does and a concept of the, you know, the its operation. And so, yes, Cisco does teach the CLI because that's how you leverage the foundational knowledge that you get in their courses. But I think what you know, this to me doesn't sound like Cisco per se. This sounds like a couple of voices inside of Cisco are saying to people. I don't think Cisco wholesale. Again, Cisco is a mammoth company. There's dozens of business units all going in different directions. A couple of them are saying, we really want to see people get into APIs. Well, yeah, of course they do. So I don't think there's any signs that there's a wholesale trend within inside of Cisco to move in that direction. There's certainly a growing trend, but it's not wholesale.
You're right. It's a few segments of Cisco, a few of the business units, but they are focusing more on this idea of turning network admins into programmers or turning programmers into network admins. And I think that's not the right path. Because programming takes a very special mindset. The skills are easy. You can learn a language. That's not a problem. It's the mindset around programming, which has that mindset. And network engineers have a different mindset. Again, you can teach a technology, but it's the thinking, the process, all the things that professionals do to manage a network and to answer responses. And so, and those two skill sets don't necessarily those two mindsets. Mm-hmm. Don't necessarily work well together, but Cisco is seeing this change to SDN and looking at network admins, enterprise IT turning into programmers, you know, more professional programmers is not effective. Now a value added reseller could add value with integration, and integrators are already doing this, and that's where the target focus should be. Not so much turning enterprise network admins into programmers or DevOps, whatevers. Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be careful with the way we use the term programming when we talk about this. I don't think Cisco is saying you have to go out and start developing applications. They're saying, at least these voices inside the organization, however many there are saying you've got to start becoming more comfortable with programmatic interfaces with wide-scale automation as opposed to hand customization of configurations.
Well, yeah, but what they're describing though, Drew, is replacing the CLI with the API, mm-hmm. which you know, so you're still going to write scripts, but instead of doing a screen scrape on an iOS command line, you're going to call a bunch of functions using wget or some other HTTP library, and you're going to process responses. Right.
I don't think that's going to be true. I think you're going to end up with networking being a lot like Windows. I'll beg to differ, I guess, right?
Well, that's where it should go.
Yeah. If you're a Windows administrator, 90% of people use the GUI, and all they understand is that the GUI does the things that they want, and 10% of people can use PowerShell. to really make it hum, to do some amazing stuff. And then on top of Microsoft Windows Server platforms, you can then buy a range of tools that then use the APIs that let you do things. The 10% are there. They can write their own code. They can script their own stuff. They can even glue various apps that administer the underlying system together. And that's the way networking is going to go. So you're going to have platforms like ACI, like NSX. You're going to have security controllers. You're going to have visibility controllers. You're going to have telemetry analytics. You're going to have big data pools. And they're all going to be pulling data from the network. And you're not going to be able to write APIs to these systems. It's just not consciously possible. In the same way that you can't manage a CLI, you are not going to write software that polls 1,500 devices in your networks and translates that into meaningful data. What you're going to do is use SDN platforms or software-defined infrastructure platforms to build your own dashboards that are meaningful to you or to do some things. Now, you might be 1 in 10 will have some coding skills, and you'll be able to write a module that'll plug into the thing to do a specific thing that, you know, maybe it's to export data from ACI into VMware, or maybe to link OpenStack down to a Neutron plugin that you particularly want to use and you need to do some slight changes. Those small things, but the majority of people are just going to take the functionality that's out of the box that's in the drag and the drop interface and use it. You're not going to use the CLI, you're going to use the GUI.
No, I agree completely with you, Greg, and I think it's going to go one step further. So ACI is an example of what you just described, and I think it's going to go one step further. I think the automation has to get to the point where, and this is specifically in the context of a conversation we had at Cisco Live with some of the execs. You know, they were talking about network or application developers, you know, having a set of APIs to write to the network, and my point to them was, they shouldn't even have to do that. They should say, I have this widget and that widget, and these two widgets talk. That's it. That's the sum total of what they should be saying. And maybe they might say, you know, I need this to be really low latency, or I need this to be really high bandwidth. You know, something along those lines, but very, very much intent-based. And then the network figures it out, right? The network, scare quotes, you know, the APIC controller says, okay, this voice application needs to have, I need to guarantee, you know, less than 5% jitter and, you know, less than 100 milliseconds. So I'm gonna take that off your plate, right? So
yeah,
application development, you know, that's the step that needs to sort of happen. So the network really becomes just this invisible plumbing.
Yeah, programming the CLI or configuring the CLI is not a skill, in the same way that using a pen is not a skill. Or being able to type on a computer is not a skill. It's something that you just have to have. The skill is how you enable that. So the CLI is going to go away to be replaced by GUI. And for a small number of users, let's say 1 in 10, they will have advanced powers or advanced training or advanced, you know, capabilities to be able to do something more. I think, you know, calling the CLI dead is untrue, because the CLI never went away from Linux just because we could have put a GUI on it. But there are people who use both, and that's what you're going to see. And a steady migration over time.
Sticking with CLI and CCIEs, we had talked a little bit about CLI being part of CCIE training. Tom Hollingsworth, also known as the Networking Nerd Online, he has a critique of the CCIE routing and switching written exam. We've got a link to the blog in the show notes, but the critique follows a couple of main points. One, he's saying the test is just poorly written with grammar and spelling mistakes and confusing or misleading answer sections. And two, he's saying the test doesn't actually cover study materials, and given that the time and money people put into those prep materials, I think that's a serious concern. I'm curious if you guys have heard any complaints about the exam, and is this something Cisco needs to pay attention to?
So a couple of points. One is, I remember talking to Cisco in years gone by, and somebody inside of their organization said each CCIE that's trained is responsible for $20 million worth of sales per headcount on average, right? And they actually, you know, when salespeople start at Cisco, the first question that salespeople are taught to ask is, where's the CCIE? Because the CCIE is your greatest ally and the person who's most likely to keep Cisco inside the organization, because they've made a mammoth personal commitment to being to Cisco, you know, through their training and their resources. So they're the people who are going to be Cisco's greatest sales ally inside of the business. So take that as you will. That's absolutely, I've seen that material come out of Cisco in past gone by. So what is true is any number of people I've spoken to, I've long since stopped doing my CCI written exam because it's turned into a game of Trivial Pursuit. The questions are pointless. They don't have any relevance to what's happening in the industry if you're forward-looking. If you're looking backwards at a 20-year-old way of things are operating, it's a great way for doing that. But when you do the questions, they're asking you extremely trivial, pointless, niche-focused stuff. The questions are often wrong or false. The questions are badly written. The exam platform that they use is a disgusting tool from about 1960, and it's ugly and it's unreliable. It crashes. Everything about the certification process that we have today is a misery, but the CCI written exam has been bad for well over 8 to 10 years, and the bitterness level has been rising for some period of time, and to see it break out is actually quite good, I must say. And you know, it needs to be done, right? If Cisco wants to maintain touch with its greatest allies inside of their customers, they need to find a way to bridge into these people, or they're going to turn around and say, you know what, maybe I should be looking elsewhere because I'm not particularly happy with the way I'm being treated here. If I'm going to be a CCIE or a CCNA, CCMP, I need to have exams that are of, you know, real quality, that challenge me but are not unreasonably stupid. Otherwise, I'm just going to let the certification go and I'm going to move on. Cisco makes a handsome profit out of training, not just in terms of how much they charge for the exams and the resources and stuff like that, but because the people that it produces out of that become Cisco's greatest, you know, allies and its most loyal customers. And if it's doing something wrong to actually alienate people in this process, then it needs to fix that pretty pronto, I would suggest out loud.
All right, well, Cisco test folks, if you're listening, here's some forewarning.
Yeah, I've criticized Cisco's training department before pretty heavily. I basically think that whoever it is that's running that business needs to be rotated out, and a whole new approach needs to be taken. And the whole pedagogy, the whole way that they approach customers and the way that they structure the business needs to start right the way, probably from Chuck Robbins down. They need to refocus a commitment, stop treating it like an alien that, you know, I wish it would go away type thing, and put somebody in charge who knows what's going on.
All right. One more Cisco story, SpringPath, which helped Cisco bring out its HyperFlex converged infrastructure. Story coming from the Register saying that SpringPath is now going to solely focus on Cisco development.
So when SpringPath came out, can you remember what I said about it?
I believe you said something along the lines of they might get, you know, picked up by Cisco or just go all Cisco.
Yay me! Because that's exactly what they said. So Chris Mellott, who knows a lot about storage and seems to be able to wheedle his way around the industry, SpringPath, of course, is the company that does the distributed storage system underneath HyperFlex. And so it's now becoming a Cisco-only development shop, and it's winding back its sales presence to other people. And we know that Cisco already owns – the rumor is that Cisco owns the majority shareholding of SpringPath, and – on one hand, Cisco doesn't want to alienate EMC and HPE and Nutanix and blah, blah, blah. On the other hand, they want to have a storage engine which is their own, that they've got full control of it, and they can go to customers and say one throat to choke, one thing to have. And they've sort of got the best of all worlds here.
All right. Well, chalk that up to your foresight.
Wee! I get one right.
We'll have a dance. Okay, before we go on, I want to thank today's sponsor, IT Pro TV, and this episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools needed to prepare for your IT certification. And Greg, you can tell us a little bit more.
Well, considering we just talked about certification and access to quality resources, maybe this is quite relevant today. So mostly what most people do is get a hold of a textbook and start reading it and reread a bunch of web pages. But you can complement that with a video provider who provides you with access to courses. Now, IT Pro TV is the first IT video provider with courses for sale through Amazon's Video Direct. So while those subscriptions are still the best value, you can actually go and buy that content directly on Amazon. You don't have to go and pay for a subscription anymore if you don't want to, maybe if you just want one or two. There's over 1,000 hours of up-to-date video content, and new courses are being added weekly. Now we have course topics on Microsoft Server, ethical hacking, virtualization, cryptography, Metasploit, and much, much more. There's one low subscription price if you want it. There's corporate and group pricing available. Go and get the boss to whip his credit card out. And like I said, it's a great way to complement your training at the very least, is to get in front of those video courses and get that stuff through your eyeballs to reinforce what you're reading in the textbooks and from the website.
All right, so check out itpro.tv to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 a year, but we have a special offer. Just visit itpro.tv/networkbreak. Use the code networkbreak30, and you get to try it free for 7 days. Plus, you'll save 30% off the life of your account. Thanks, ITPro TV. Okay, so here's a story that is not about Cisco. At the start of 2016, Microsoft announced tech previews for Azure Stack, which is an on-premise version of its IaaS PaaS platform for building private and hybrid clouds. And now this week, Microsoft announced it's going to deliver Azure Stack as an integrated system with a bundle of software, hardware, support, and services. And the partners that have been announced for that are Dell, HPE, and Lenovo, although others are probably going to be included.
So what I think Microsoft is saying here is we don't want to sell you Microsoft's Azure Stack, which is the private cloud version of Windows Server. If you want to buy it, you have to go and buy it with hardware. And that's the major transition. Mm-hmm. The question is, why does Windows want to do that?
I think they're going after ease of use. They want it to be as easy as possible. And so their rationale is, you know, we'll certify these providers to make sure that it's running properly, et cetera, et cetera. It's customized to run all of our special bits and goodies. So buy this, it's guaranteed to work, rack it up and start running, as opposed to you get the software and then, you know, put it on your own systems and figure it all out.
Yep. It's enabling their hardware partners, and it's enabling their hardware partners downstream channel to do resell to make it really easy to drop in Azure Stack in a very painless way to get customers up and running, and then enable that transition from public to hybrid to perhaps, I'm sorry, from private to hybrid to perhaps public cloud using Azure.
I guess they stole all that money in Office 365 from resellers, so they've got to give them something, haven't they? It's hard to find a business that isn't using Office 365 Mail, right? And that's a lot of Exchange licenses and servers and professional services and storage and networking business that just went out the business, out the door. So maybe this is a bit of a backhander to resellers to say, here you go, you can sell your customers a private cloud, but you can only sell it through Dell, HP, and Lenovo, who's the last of the loyal, you know, resellers.
Right.
Go
ahead, Mike.
Go ahead. I was going to say it also might be in response to the growing popularity of hyperconverged infrastructure and you know, preconfigured systems like, you know, VCE and so on. So it's, you know, there's a lot of gears moving there.
Do you ever? Here's a theory for you, pet theory. I'm not sure if it's a prediction, but it's just possible that Microsoft doesn't want to sell this product. Why would you want to gear up with, you know, hundreds of sales, thousands of salespeople all across the world and send them out to go and knock on doors of the enterprise and convince customers to upgrade to Azure when you can just hand it over to Dell, HP, Lenovo and say, here you go, here's your chance to make money, off you go. And then Microsoft doesn't have to have salespeople, they don't have to have managers, they don't have to do, it's all gone, blah. And then they're all focusing on Azure public cloud. They don't have to worry about, you know, people being distracted by private cloud stuff. It's just a Windows Server product. It's already said that Windows Server is kind of not the future of the company. So maybe this just leaves them focused on Azure and the private cloud and the apps that run on it, and then says, Azure private cloud in over there, knock, knock, bye.
Yeah, would you rather talk to 1,000 VARs or 10,000 customers? It makes sense for them to, you know, yes, to offload all that work. You know, and it incentivizes their their hardware partners and incentivizes their hardware partners' channel to sell more stuff with Azure. So, yeah.
Okay. More cynical.
It's easy to be cynical.
It really is. It's so much fun, too.
Especially where Microsoft's concerned. It is good that, you know, it is giving its, you know, Dell, HP, Lenovo, who's been very loyal to Microsoft over the years, giving them a chance to, you know, get some revenue while they transition through the public-private cloud thing. And give customers a reason. And as you say, hyperconverged and converged systems are popular amongst enterprises, but that's partly because everything's getting smaller. I don't need to buy 10 racks worth of gear anymore. I can buy one rack and do it all in one rack. So
one thing is that we haven't actually seen any of the big vendors be really successful in trying to link private and public cloud yet. So this is Microsoft's foray here, but nobody else has really done it well.
Yeah, I think that's part of the play. Part of the reason behind this is Azure Private Cloud was meant to be using the same APIs and the same internal structures as Azure Public Cloud. And you could either be using the public cloud and then bring it back onto this, or vice versa. You can, and it was seen to being a gateway to Azure Public Cloud. So maybe the take up of the public cloud is such that Microsoft doesn't feel the need to push this along.
Could be. All right, something we'll keep an eye on. A report from Gartner talking about the worldwide software security market, which grew 3.7% last year. However, while overall growth was up, four out of the five biggest security software vendors saw their revenue go down. The biggest drop was for Symantec, whose security software revenue fell 6.2%. The other vendors who saw a dip included Intel, Trend Micro, and EMC. It was only IBM who saw its security software revenue go up by 2.5%.
Can I say I told you so?
Sure, you can say whatever you want.
I told you so. I told you that the security market wasn't going to grow indefinitely.
Well, hold on. Wait. The security market did grow overall. It was just these big vendors who saw their revenue drop.
No. There's a lot more security products in the market being sold and a lot more subscription revenue. So the 3.7% growth is just the shift from buying appliances to software subscriptions as people get, as I say, enterprises are happy to spend more money without any reason whatsoever. But the security industry didn't grow. Nobody likes security. Nobody wants security. People don't like paying for business insurance or buying business insurance. This is just blah. People bought a little bit more because of, you know, all the things that happened in terms of security. But it's not critical. It's not massive. It's not a huge thing. No one cares about security. That hasn't changed in 20 years.
Well, if you look at three of these companies, Symantec and Intel with its McAfee acquisition and Trend Micro, those are traditionally antivirus, anti-malware vendors. And that software, you know, for a long time has been criticized as being perhaps ineffective, just one of those things you have to have, but nobody really wants. And I think this is coming back to bite them. It's starting to hurt them.
Well, yeah, and in the press release from Gartner, it sort of indicates that, right? The declines came mostly from the consumer side, and there's plenty of free antivirus, even from Microsoft. That's perfectly serviceable. So it's going to start declining, and you know that report also shows that IBM's increase came mostly from its security information event management software, which is more of the big ticket items from enterprises. So you see, it sounds like it's compression in the consumer space.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And then don't forget too that people are replacing computers with smartphones and tablets that don't need those sorts of product, don't need desktop or endpoint security tools like we used to. Which, interestingly, is the market that Cisco's getting into, right, with OpenDNS and LANCOPE. Some of that's in the consumer space or the endpoint space. But, you know, the whole security spending thing is just a temporary thing. It'll be fixed by next year when it'll be declining it sweetly by 5 to 10%.
Okay, prediction for the books.
Write that down, Drew, because we're going to come back to it in a year.
And speaking of security software, antivirus vendor Avast is buying antivirus vendor AVG for $1.3 billion. The merger is designed to boost efficiency, and Avast will get AVG's mobile antivirus product.
Who knew that AVG was still in business was one comment I saw somebody say. There's too many antivirus vendors in the market. I don't think anybody can disagree. So for some of them for some convergence and to take them out of the market and get access to those customers and the revenue is absolutely normal for a market in this cycle. What they effectively Avast is effectively doing is buying market share.
Yeah, this is a very mature market, so it's not surprising to see consolidation. Okay, our last story for this episode. Sticking with security, researchers from Cisco found a method for identifying malware in encrypted TLS without having to decrypt the traffic first. That's pretty cool.
No, it is pretty cool. And one of the things that I've always maintained is the wealth of information you can pull just by looking at application behavior is pretty incredible. And that's what they're describing, looking at how the flow behaves, everything from timing to packet sizes to what's contained in the certificate. All of that is really interesting information. And if it's very deep knowledge stuff, but it's kind of amazing. And a lot of the SD-WAN vendors are using essentially passive application fingerprinting, looking at flows and just at flows to make a determination that some what traffic is, whether it's voice or video or screen sharing or what have you, particularly in sort of multimodal applications like Link and other UC&C apps. So, I mean, this is interesting, kind of short on detail of how they did it, but certainly seems pretty viable.
So a few details. The researchers, they looked at 18 malware families and determined that the malware, and I'm quoting from the research here, the malware typically uses older and weaker cryptographic parameters. So they looked at the unencrypted handshake messages and then used some machine learning and based on this notion about the using the older and weaker encryption parameters allowed them to do some identification without having to decrypt the whole transmission.
They basically fingerprinted malware by identifying that it's using obsolete crypto suites.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's not actually all that great.
Why not?
Except for the fact that they discovered it with machine learning. So if a key part of your vector for discovery is the fact that people are using obsolete crypto suites because the people who write malware aren't very good programmers, that's not news. And, you know, and it's also only 90% accurate. That means at 10% false positive rate, that's a heinous crime in real terms. That's not an advance as such.
Well, no. What's interesting about it is they're doing the detection based on the little bit of information that they can see, and it's consistent, you know, regardless of where they're seeing it. And so it shows sort of the value of doing behavior anomaly detection. And you're right, Greg. I mean, so it's 90% effective. It's not going to be 100%. The same thing as doing passive OS detections, not 100% either. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty interesting. And if you were to do, say, an OS detection, let's say that you have an architecture where you've got a Linux box running in GenX sitting in front of a bunch of Microsoft web servers. Mm-hmm. Right. When you look at that traffic and you do the OS detection, you'll see Linux box running IIS. Well, that's crazy. But what do you infer from that? That there's something sitting between you and that Microsoft web server.
Yeah.
That's Linux based. So you start learning things, which is interesting.
No, I don't know. I mean, seems a bit of a beat up to me.
I don't think this is going to, you know, rock the computer security world, but I think it becomes another data point, another arrow in the arsenal.
Yeah,
for your analysis.
Well, I think ultimately the idea of doing in-network analysis of encrypted flows is utterly pointless. I'm much more of a fan of the sort of concepts of what Bromium is doing with its use of truth jails or virtualization containers where you actually download the payload of whatever it is you want, but you run it in an isolated container in the desktop operating system to check whether there's some form of malware in it. And if something goes wrong, you just throw the whole container away. There's no way that you can escape from the container. The networking companies are continually trying to say, I can put something in the network that can solve the problems of the endpoints. And every time we do it, consistently for the past 20 years, it's failed miserably. It's actually ended up making everything worse. And this is another attempt to say, oh, you know, if we could just put something in the router, something in the network, we could fix all of the problems. And it never, ever works out. 90% rate in a research paper isn't enough to warrant putting any more funding down, I think.
I'm going to argue with you on this point because I've seen it. I've seen anomaly detection work in a variety of methods, and I'm not going to tell you that, and nobody should tell you that it should be the sole source of truth or it should be the sole control that you ever use. And anybody who says they have the product that's going to be the sole control is really kind of missing the point. Even your friends at Bromium, as cool as that product is it deployed everywhere 100%? You know, and you know, you need that kind of coverage. And so, while I'm not a fan of necessarily the multi-layer security model, because that just means that breeds complexity and expense and all the rest of it. Mm. The ability to detect traffic fairly accurately, malicious traffic, is far more interesting than not. An example, and this is an example that I actually saw when I was testing a bunch of anomaly detection systems. I had it sitting on a live network, and you know, they had an intrusion detection. You know, the organization had IDSs set up to detect stuff, and I was finding these products were finding attacks based on behavior that these IDSs did not detect. And so we're sitting in front of a bunch of mail servers, and I started seeing TFTP traffic going basically going off site.
Yeah.
And so I contacted him. I said, hey, you know, and I told him what was going on. Is this, should you be seeing that? You know, no.
I'm not saying it's useless. I'm saying that my belief is that any form of in-network detection and monitoring and blocking is temporary, and compared to the cost and the problems associated with deploying it, it never actually stacks up. You are much better off investing in endpoint security. Now, whether that's just getting away from Microsoft Windows because it's obviously insecure and replacing it with some sort of secure endpoint, right? Or whether that's using smartphones instead of Windows desktops because of that. It's much easier to control tablets and so forth. Or whether it's using a form of endpoint security that's not malware virus scanning, that's something else, like Bromium is the example I'm giving you. That's what I'm saying. Not saying that it doesn't work. I'm taking a much more holistic view and saying SIEMs, IDSs, anomaly detection systems, whatever they are, they're only short-term. They only ever last for a couple of years before they stop being useful. Then they just become a massive burden operationally, and the vendors don't even want them. I mean, look at Cisco. Cisco's got some of the best IDS systems in the world, and they've been steadily walking backwards from that market for the past 5 years and going, you know, this is just not a winning game. And even when they bought IronPort and the mail scanning engine that they've got, they haven't been exactly, you know, they've sold lots of that, but they're not out there promoting that they've got a world-class capability. They're steadily backing away from it and saying, just put it all in the firewall. We'll just, you know, right at the edge of the network. That's the sort of thing I'm saying, is it doesn't last for long.
Well, so I would take a more targeted view and say, you know, if I could wave my magic wand, mm-hmm. Security would be addressed in the application code itself. And that means secure development lifecycle. That means, you know, training all developers into really just basic sort of common sense programming to stop buffer overflows, to do parameter checking, to do all kinds of other things. But we don't live in that ideal world. And even if we did, there's enough weirdness in hardware that's not controllable, or worse, in libraries that are imported. And there's a whole sort of chain of things where, whether or not it's no one system is going to be perfect. And this is why we end up with this sort of this layered approach, but it needs to be rationalized. And certainly maintaining IDS signatures and maintaining anomaly detection signatures, it's an expense for the companies that have to build them. But, you know, it's necessary for the time being.
But as applications are becoming inherently more secure. So if you take a quick look around the market today, people are building things like iCloud and Dropbox, and they're not having security problems. So do you really want to keep introducing legacy solutions for legacy problems when the modern era is already showing us that you can build secure apps, and that increasingly over time you won't have to use middle boxes to patch bad applications because everything will be broadly fixed?
That's remarkably optimistic for you, Greg.
I know, Greg. What's up?
did you fall over while we were recording?
I mean, it's the reality is security doesn't matter. However, any way that you cut it, right, the fact that you can detect malware in the network is great, but the simple point of fact is that ISPs don't filter out non-bad ASs in the network. They won't filter it. They won't block, you know, entire data centers in Bulgaria or you know, countries like that that are known sinks of malware. The ISPs won't filter them, or they won't take any action against each other. They don't even do, like, edge validation. Anybody can set up, an IP address. Like, you can watch online as the internet backbone as China pulls the U.S. Department of Defense's IP ranges into itself and tries to literally funnel all the traffic through China. And yet, nobody wants to fix that. Nobody wants to implement BGP RPKI. Nobody wants to fix any of that, right? So why are you getting bent out of shape about anomaly detection for a handful of people at the edge of the network?
Because that's the only place that enterprises have control. Because you're right, there's a lot of things that can happen elsewhere that is beyond the enterprise's control. But in spite of that, they still have to operate. And they still have to operate.
The enterprise is long since gone. It's in telephone. It's in smartphones. It's in tablets. It's in laptops wandering off around the world. I mean, people still take their corporate laptops to China, for goodness sakes, right? That horse has bolted, right? You're never getting that back. So no. You've got to have in-network anomaly detection for the enterprise is a complete fallacy.
No, no, no. It's one tool of many that IT can use or not. That will help, right? And it's not always going to be a fit for all organizations because anomaly detection is great if you know what to do, what to look for, and you have the expertise to
so anomaly
that.
Detection inside the data center, I'm in with that, right? If you're trying to detect lateral escalation, as people try and move laterally inside your data center, fine, I'm down with that. Everything else, waste of time and money.
All right, guys, I'm going to break in and just you can carry this debate on elsewhere, but let's not abuse our listeners, please. Sure. All right, so this brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to get more from you, where can they find it?
They can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com on social media as etherealmind.
Mike, how about you?
M. Fratto on Twitter and LinkedIn.
All right, and I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow me on Twitter at Drew_CM. Thanks to our sponsor, IT Pro TV, and thanks, Mike, for being our guest this week. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, please give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your colleagues. And check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find how to get those at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.